an interview with Amy Lee for the Youngstown State University Project North American Indians by Jay Toth at Kent State University on June 2nd, 1979 at 11 a.m. What I want to do is start out by asking you to give me some of your past family history, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, whatever you can remember.
Okay. Instant recollection isn't necessarily as much as I know. I do have a lot of family items and histories written down, but off the top of my head, half of my family was virtually destroyed by the fact that both of my grandparents, who were Seneca, were blind, and my father was taken away from them and adopted out to a white family. Therefore, and he didn't have a birth certificate. Native Americans don't traditionally use birth certificates. Therefore, I lost all contact and record of that. He had several brothers and sisters who were also adopted out or shipped out to orphanages in other states, and we've only found one of them so far. The investigation I've done over the last 10 years back at the Allegheny Reservation trying to find out that side of the family has ended in mostly frustration, but a few good contacts and finding a few relatives. On my mother's side, it's Mohawk and minimal Cherokee, probably a little bit of Seneca too, because the Mohawks and Senecas intermarried so frequently. And I'd say my grandparents and parents were victimized by the non-Indian society that said being Indian isn't the best thing to be. Indians' places on the movie screen being killed by John Wayne and company. And they really bought that whole bit that it wasn't good to be Indian, that the only good one was a dead one, etc. So they didn't promote any pride in it, because they didn't have any pride in it. And they stripped themselves and submitted to being stripped of their own Indian cultural identities. So it's only my generation that seems to be actively seeking Indianness. And luckily, I have the support of my parents. And before my grandparents died, I had their support, too.
Can you recall your grandmother? You know, some mm-hmm. events you had with your grandmother?
Mainly just domestic type things. My grandmother was a farm woman predominantly, which most Senecas, Iroquois people are agrarian. And just lots of fond memories of old recipes and making soap, lye soap, and the accents and the mixed language of English and native languages. Combination of contrasts and contradictions, which is what the Indian existence is, a lot of contradictions, because a lot of the non-Indian things just don't mesh well. And
can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, traditional home with a toaster and a blender in it. It's just not quite right. It's a little bit off, and our whole existence is a little bit off. Nothing quite blends. You either can be real traditional or real non-Indian contemporary, but I don't know that too many people have succeeded at either one of those pure strains of being totally contemporary or totally traditional. So we're stuck in the middle, having the values of a Native American, and those values are constantly being challenged by everything we see, the media, the government, the United States government, our own governments, the nation's governments, who have been infiltrated and manipulated by the United States government. The whole existence has been infiltrated and bombarded and challenged. Everything from all media, Cherokee Red Pop and Dandy potato chips, that little savage hopping around with a tomahawk on it. We're ridiculed all the time, and that makes for a very strained existence. It's hard to be an Indian and still have any dignity about it. And so in our homes, you'll see some homes will have the caricatures, the cartoons, and you gotta wonder if they really think Indians should be poked fun at or not. But a lot of Native Americans poke fun at themselves, not because they think it's funny, but because they'd rather do it than be made fun of. And I think my grandparents were no exception to that. A bizarre combination of traditional items and hokey Hong Kong Indian crap.
Was there any time that your mother related incidents to you?
About what? I mean, she talked to me all my life.
Yeah. As far as white and Indian relationships. You know, like you were saying, they have to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And they did accept it.
Yeah.
And a lot of Indians say this, but they don't explain the songs.
Okay. My parents raised me very traditionally by exposing me to all different facets of life. They weren't afraid for me to go out and view other cultures and other political governments and other people of different ethnic backgrounds. For instance, I went to a Black Baptist church in a rural ghetto, Skills and McAlbrough here, the largest rural ghetto in the United States. I went there for a while. I was the only non-Black person, and I got to appreciate and know intimately their particular culture. Through just a myriad of occupations, my father and my mother took me many places to see many things, everything from living in a log cabin in Minnesota in the forest where there were no neighbors who were human beings, just animals, to living in an orphanage in Pittsburgh while they were house parents. That was a traditional way, not the traveling so much, but the way of exposing me to all sorts of things and letting me make up my own mind about what was good. That's the traditional way to do it. And that's how they relate not only the culture that I have actively decided to live, the native culture, but they let me make sure that was the best culture for me. They let me have the option to become an Apple Indian or just fake it and pretend to be like a white person all my life, or to be a traditionalist. And I like to think that they are proud that I chose the traditional way. It's something that they didn't have an option to do when they were growing up.
What were your experiences in school?
They were interesting. A lot of racism. A lot of times you just sit through it because I was a minority of one, and minorities of one just can't do too much when they're outnumbered by 40 other kids in the classroom. To this day, I think probably 3/4 of my classmates don't even think of me as Native American, not because I said otherwise, but because I just didn't go around saying I was one. It was easier just to not say, but just to be. And because I don't fit the stereotypes that we were all force-fed what an Indian should look like, I got by a lot easier than somebody who perhaps had the jet black hair, the hooked nose, high cheekbones, dark skin, and brown eyes. It might have been even rougher for that individual. The things I recall most are not being allowed to wear my long ribbon dresses, traditional garments. While they were measuring other girls' skirts because they were too short, they were always telling me mine were too long. I had to wear the conformed style, the conformed length of right above the kneecap, I believe, in those days. Also, they wanted me to cut my hair because I'm a woman, remember? Usually they pick on men for this. They wanted me to cut my hair because it was a hindrance, etc. Well, this is something that's been happening all over the country for years, that once somebody finds out that hair is like the old Samson myth from the Bible, that strength and power and in our case very important part of our culture, it seems that's what they go after. I know many Native individuals who have had to hack their hair off, men and women, to conform to whatever situation they were in.
What's some of the situations that you know of?
Right now I've got a friend in jail in Oklahoma who's had his hair tied to the bars of the jail. He got picked up for having an eagle feather, even though it's legal for Indians to have eagle feathers. It's nice to harass Indians over that because, you know, they have to go through the whole rigmarole of proving their Indianness, etc., while they're in jail, which is virtually impossible to do. And his hair was tied to the bars, and then they said, oh, gee, we've made a real mess of your hair here. We're just going to have to cut it off. And his hair was longer than mine, below his waist. It was really beautiful. And there's his picture of him. That's one incident. There's so many. I think we integrate these incidents just totally into our life, and to pick them out, it's possible to do, but instead we just file it away because there are so many of them.
Why did you decide to come to school at Kent State?
Half of my family had relocated here. I never thought really of going anyplace but Kent State, because from being a little child, I'd always visited the area and had some really fond and romantic memories of Kent, May Day, Campus Queen, and all that kind of stuff that every average little girl dreams of. But by the time I got here, I realized that that wasn't why I came here. I came here to be a political activist. And that's what I am. It's a good place to be that. There's a lot of suppression, but there is everywhere. But it's very fertile ground because I can have a platform here, and it's one that's desperately needed. There are people here who are interested in Indians, but all they know about us is what they see on TV. And they want to know more about us, and this is a passive way of changing the Indian existence, making it for the better by teaching, education. My major here is peaceful change, and that is what I believe in. Education is the most peaceful way to do it.
Can you relate some incidents in your class as far as the students' attitudes that you come across?
Oh, boy. I wish I had time to prepare a study for this one because it's really fascinating. Over the 3 years I've taught American Indian Studies, I deal mainly in the stereotypes and the racism. This is a subtle type of racism around here. There just aren't that many Indians, therefore the racism is one of ignorance, sheer ignorance, and not other forms of prejudice. The stereotypes are... they run the whole gamut of the physical impression. People insist that we look a certain way, and that if we don't look a certain way, then we can't be Indian. Then they have this peculiar notion, almost every student I've ever had to begin with has this notion that Indians come in fractions. You can be a quarter blood or a half breed or a full blood, etc. Totally ignoring the fact that blood does not come in races, but be positive, be negative, etc. But this concept of blood is in itself racist. The concept of race is racist. It wasn't designed by us as native people, but by the invader. And designed not to acknowledge and respect our differences, but to wage control over people who are different from the people who designed that concept of race. So on that premise alone, it's really difficult to get through to people when they want to know, people come into the office and go, "You can't be Indian." You know, they are that bold, whereas they wouldn't dare go down the hall to Black United Students and walk in the door and go, "You can't be black." Or they would come in and ask us, "How much Indian are you? Are you a real Indian? Are you a full-blood Indian?" Never have any of my black friends been asked if they were a full-blooded black, or a half-breed black, or a quarter-blood black. Nor would I do that to any non-Indian white person, would I ask them if they were a full-blooded white, etc. So that's the most prominent problem of racism that we have, just being recognized for who we are.
As far as the future, then you feel that education is the way?
One of the ways. It's the way I've chosen. I think it also is going to take some violence and revolution. I don't want any particular part in that. I don't think I'd be a good revolutionary. But just like the black people have made progress, they had to have the Black Panthers to get it started. And a lot of moderate black people would disagree with that and say, no, we would have been just fine without all that violence. But I think history has proven itself over and over again. You have to have the extremes to get that change. You had to have the Black Panthers to get blacks recognized. And then the moderates and the liberals can move in and reap all the benefits that the Black Panthers put their lives on the line for. Well, I'm afraid I'm not as bold as some of the American Indian Movement people. I don't want to die for a cause right now. I may end up doing that, but right now I see the wounded knees and the BIA takeovers, the more militant acts as necessary, and I'm following behind educating while they're doing that. That's just the role I'm more suited for than holding a gun.
So give me your opinion of wounded knee.
Wounded Knee 1890 was a massacre. Wounded Knee 1973, again, was almost a massacre. The only time I've ever seen on the television sets tanks rolling in to this little isolated area, totally surrounding it with more weapons than I think were ever used on Native people before. It was one incident of many in which the United States government repeatedly violated its word, and that's about the only thing I can say about it. It was necessary. It was necessary for the Native Americans to try to get the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1863 reenacted and lived up to by both parties. And I still didn't get it, but I think because of that, people started to realize, wow, you mean there are Indians left and they're still not happy? Gee. And that was good. It's good to have a focal point. The news media picks up on that, but they usually only pick up on things when we're violent, defending what's ours, or when we want land back, like the Passamaquoddies and Penobscots in Maine. It makes us look violent and greedy all the time. But the news media, for some reason, doesn't want to pick up on all the other peaceful things that we're doing to preserve our Mother Earth.
Last year was a wellness walk. Were on it.
Yes, I was one of the organizers from Ohio East. That's the kind of thing I can get into. No violence on our part, at least. Several people were injured and killed along the way. But there were no weapons inside of the encampment. And no drugs, no alcohol, no pot. It was a traditional walk uniting Native people from across the continent. And it was beautiful, spiritual, political. Probably the climax of my social, political, cultural career.
Explain to me what a day or two was like.
On the walk?
Yeah.
Ah.
From the time you got out to the time you got out.
Okay. Well, from February to May, I was an organizer, and that was all bureaucratic business stuff, phone calls, posters, printing things. And that's what I'm used to. But I was grateful to cast that aside and become just a walker. The walkers, I think, were probably the most important people. And after I joined in May, we would get up at 5, 6 in the morning. Whenever it got light, you just don't feel like sleeping in. When there's so much beauty around you, you want to absorb it all. Get up and make fry bread with some wild berries that we would pick and have breakfast. Each encampment, each nation had their own encampment.
How many people would you say were?
4,000, I believe, were in Washington.
Well, at the time you were walking, say your group.
Okay. 1,000. Give or take 500. You can't tell when you're right there. Yeah, the news people are the ones who usually give estimates like that. The Iroquois Confederacy was well represented. We were probably the largest by the time we got to Washington. The Sioux, the Lakota people, had the largest encampment before that. And being with the Iroquois Confederacy camp, it was nice because the only languages usually spoken were Iroquois dialects. And the foods we ate were all Iroquois, even though the government kept bringing in all these surplus food things for us to eat, you know, like bottles of corn syrup with recipes on the side that says, this is what you should feed your babies, corn syrup. Wow, man, I'd rather feed a baby milk from myself if I had a baby. But it's typical of governmental programs. They gave us turkey drumsticks as big as my calves that were like from 1962 frozen. They wanted us to eat this stuff. We politely said thank you, then went out to the berry patches and picked berries for our fry bread and had venison or rabbit, or sometimes people would donate a cow along the way and everybody would have a good meal that day. Well, there was a lot to be done. I mean, there was so much to do that you just had to pick and choose your priorities. Besides the cooking for everybody and making sure the elders were taken care of, the elders were our first consideration, and then the young people, and everyone else. And it was a lot to do. There were seminars going on all the time on weekends when we weren't walking, on midwifery, Indian law, legal system, Indian women's rights, because so many Indian women have been forcibly sterilized under the Indian Health Service policy that we're trying to get together to prevent this type of treatment or mistreatment. So there were seminars to enhance our awareness, and then the nights were filled with all-night-long powwows, which were great. And the days were filled with walking and talking and working together.
Okay, once you reached Washington...
Well, once we reached Washington, I see, it's a fill-in-the-blank question. Once we reached Washington... Oh, it got hectic, because that's when all the non-Indian supporters wanted to join us. And I got stuck in the white camp for a while because all of the friends from Kent here who had come up were non-Indian, and I thought I'd be with them and get them all situated and lined up and at home and ready to go as we were going to walk, I think it was 14 miles into Washington from Greenbelt Park. And I hated the white camp. It really was depressing and disorganized. I'm not sure if it's because they all got there at one point or if it had been infiltrated and made to be so sloppily cared for, or what the problem was. But I think it was that most of the people who came were typical non-Indian militants who have so many causes just so many, that instead of talking about the native things, the reason they were there, they were all talking about other places they were going to go after this, like anti-nuke rallies, and which is good, but I'd rather be concentrating on why I am in a certain place than talking about plans I had for the next day. And they were very disorganized, arguing all the time. Several of them were caught smoking pot and asked to leave. Some of them had weapons and were asked to leave. So I was not happy there at all, and eventually moved back over to the Iroquois encampment and was allowed to bring some of my friends with me. So we walked a delegation, all of us actually, about 4,000, 5,000 of us walked from Greenbelt Park, where we were encamped, to Washington. We were led by the elders who carried the sacred pipe, and then followed by, and then all Native people, and then followed by about 400 Buddhist monks who were neat. They were supporting us. They had walked almost the entire way, too. And then we were followed by black supporters and then white supporters and anybody else. And it was spiritual. It was intense. Different from any other march I've ever participated in. We walked four abreast the entire way. Very solemn. No laughing or talking. No chanting. Just the sound of the drum beat and the sound of all of our heartbeats. And it was beautiful.
And then when you reached the destination?
Yes. Well, you see, Carter knew we were coming since, after all, they were walking since February 14th. But he decided that he'd go across the salt water, the ocean, and talk about human rights instead of meeting with us, the people who have been denied human rights by the United States longer than anyone else. And he got back in time while we were there. We were there almost 2 weeks. He got back. He decided he couldn't see us. He decided to see a troop of Boy Scouts who had come from Pennsylvania, I think, instead.
Who did he send to see?
What's his vice president's name? Mondale?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's who met with us. So it was hard to tell. He just sat in the corner and listened to these beautiful old Navajo women tell him off in Navajo. And then he listened to the Lakota people try to present their proposals for human rights for Indians. And there was no response, just him sitting there, absorbing this, taking notes, and then he left. That's all the contact we had with the government, other than them bringing out security people and turkey legs and corn syrup. But it was worth it. A lot of people say, well, you mean you walked all that way for nothing? And that's not the case, because we accomplished something that the United States as a government will find even more threatening than if we'd gotten all of our treaties reenacted or whatever. We accomplished a solidarity that Native people have never known before. We've always been so divided with our own cultural differences and our own political differences. And the fact that our languages are different and the fact that we are historical enemies, many of us. But we realized on that walk that we don't have to be enemies any longer, that we have to work together to overpower programs and laws that are designed to eliminate us, to legalize us out of existence. And there are 13 bills in Congress right now which are designed to do just that, which was the basis for our walk to Washington.
What do you feel are the basis for causes of these bills?
Money. Corporations, multinational corporations who thrive on abusing land and people. Almost all of the bills were sponsored by Meads and another person in Washington, and they can all be traced back to fishing industry, coal, oil, money. It's all money.
A recent write-up in one of the newspapers was saying that these bills are, in fact, it was on the news at least. These bills are 10 years in the future.
They would take place 10 years in the future if they were
10 years
ratified?
As far as to be ratified.
I never heard that at all. This, that surprises me. It's usually Native people think far in advance. The United States usually doesn't plan that far in advance. It seems to me that they live for the day 10 years from now. I think some of those fuels that they're trying to rip off of Indian land will be extinct. They won't be the type of fuels that most people will be needing. I didn't hear that at all. I'd be interested in following up on that. To me, it sounds like if they were approved, they would go into action right away. And if they did, I don't think there would be any more fish or water in 10 years, the way those bills were phrased for the fishing corporations to get in there to Indian lands and deprive the Indians of fish. There certainly wouldn't be too many Indians in 10 years.
Okay.
I think we're no, we're still going. I thought it had stopped.
Right now, we've all got problems as far as reservation and high, powerful tribal leaders.
Yeah.
From the Navajo Reservation to Pine Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
To the one you're very familiar with.
Yep.
Can we just discuss that particular person?
Okay. Don't want to be slanderous at all.
Hey.
I don't want to have my legs broken at all, is what I'm saying. It's cowboys and Indians without the cowboys up at Allegheny Reservation. And I guess I was naive about that for some time. I guess it's been that way a long time. There are two governments, the traditional government and the government that was set up by the state of New York and the United States of America. And unfortunately, well, obviously, the government that the United States put there, that's the government they're going to listen to and they're going to manipulate. They don't listen to the traditional government at all. The sellout government, or whatever phrase we can use to, the modern government, the contemporary government, is a council system where the elections are rigged or bought, the votes are bought, commonplace practice. And in fact, the president of the nation admitted to paying for votes. He admitted that on the federal jury investigation. He was on trial for embezzlement and bribery, where it came out to his benefit, where he said, yeah, I buy my votes, or yeah, I can manipulate elections, and there's not a thing you can do about it because we're a separate nation from the United States. Now, this is something we've wanted recognized for years, that we are a separate nation. But then if we are a separate nation, what is he doing in power? Because the United States set up that government and totally has disregard for the traditional government. It's a catch-22 over and over again.
You had a particular incident.
Oh, my class and I were banned from the reservation. we're allowed on now, I guess. I mean, we went up there last weekend and lived to talk about it. I'm not exactly sure what happened, except while he was under a lot of pressure being on trial for embezzlement, etc., he received, through his security agents who went through my maps in the building where we were staying while I was out, went through the maps, found a handout sheet that I used to circulate, one that I don't even circulate any longer, that listed in my flippant and dry humor the different places we could go, things we could do, people we could see. He found great offense at this. It wasn't meant for him. It wasn't meant for anyone but those students. And not even for this particular class, because it was outdated. A third of the places on the map were closed. But he took great offense at the way I phrased things, and then proceeded to write a letter, not to me, but to the president of this university, banning my class and me from my own reservation, mind you, because we were there to provoke... We were banned from the reservation because allegedly we were there to incite violence, and we were supposedly practicing racism, which I haven't figured out yet, since my major is peaceful change, and if my words sound violent, it's not that I'm provoking at all. They're just my opinions, and my students know that. Anyway, the students responded with tears and anger, and all of them wrote letters saying why they went up to the reservation, not to change the reservation, but to meet some of the people I had talked to them about, my friends and family up there, and to have a good time. It is a tourist area. It's not a closed reservation. And then I had professors who had gone up on the trips before write letters, and before I knew it, a whole support committee had started. And when I flew up to meet with the president of the nation, I had a few copies of letters that I knew about, and I went into his office, and on his desk was a stack, probably 8 inches deep, of letters he had received in support of my class. But the repercussions, after meeting with his associates, we were allowed to come back. He hasn't refused, he just hasn't come through by putting it in writing yet, which I have asked for. I guess everything is all right, though. A few people don't seem to know that everything's okay.
Yeah, I found out.
Right, as you found out at 3 a.m. on the other weekend when somebody walked in the house and said, Bob Hope said you guys weren't allowed to be here anymore or something like that. That's the trouble. The news communication isn't working too well up there. They ran an Associated Press article that hit here, of course, that we were banned from the reservation. Now I think they need to do us justice and release one that says we're allowed back on, because the repercussions are numerous. Once we got back here, I was told I wasn't allowed to teach any longer until I worked that one out, too, with more letters and more support committees.
Can you elaborate on the conversation between you and Kent State?
Yeah, I can. It's... let me back up and say it resulted in never being finished. The conversation wasn't. I think it would have ended in a lawsuit where I'm sure I would have won, but the gentleman who made the allegations fell over dead of a heart attack a few hours after, saying he never wanted to see me again. So we never got to finish that with a lawsuit at all, and I'm totally frustrated at not being able to finish up something he had started. But that's something I have to work out.
He is
the dean of the Honors and Experimental College, and he called me in allegedly just to pick out a room number for teaching next fall. And before the hour and a half was up, he had called me everything from a fraud to a liar, an imposter, and silly. Thought I was silly too. Like that hurt more than anything. He asked for immediate proof of my credentials and my Indianness, and that totally frustrated me. I gave him every ID card I had on me at the time, which was considerable, but I didn't have my birth certificate, which he asked for. He asked if I carried my birth certificate around with me. And it was very rude and pompous, and it was violating federal law. You're not allowed to ask a person his race or her race, which would have been probably the basis for the lawsuit. That and the fact that he called me a fraud as well. So after producing all the identification I possibly had, many things that did say I was a Native American, which to me doesn't mean I am a Native American. Paper doesn't make a person who they are. That's what he wanted proof in the form of paper. He literally threw the cards, ID cards, back at me and said they were all worthless. And my only response was, quick, prove you're Jewish. You know, there's just no way to prove one's race unless you fit the stereotypes, and even then there are so many exceptions. A lot of my friends who are Caucasians, who are Mediterranean people, are darker than some of my black friends.
You were saying that when you met with Bob Hope,
mm-hmm.
His counsel told him that he had no leg to stand on.
I don't recall saying that his counsel told him that, but it is a fact. He did have no leg to stand on because of the laws there, state laws and federal law. He can't kick me off of my own reservation. And there was no violation. We didn't do anything wrong. He couldn't really prevent my group from coming up again, especially since it's an open reservation that is allegedly encouraging tourism.
Your friend is on the newspaper down there.
Mm-hmm.
He was on a...
He interviewed at a press conference after Bob Hope was acquitted of embezzlement. He's the one who wrote the Associated Press article and released it. And, oh, in the article, Bob Hope also could have gotten himself in trouble again. He said, to quote, regarding us ever coming up again, somebody's going to get hurt, and it's not going to be us. That was his quote. Now, that wasn't very diplomatic, because if I'd even gotten in a car accident or anything when we'd gone up there, it would have looked very suspicious for him. And that type of violence does occur up there, which is not something we'd like to admit to, but it is a reality.
Your impressions of the reservation at the present time?
are depressing. That's what my impressions are. The drug abuse and the alcoholism and the unemployment, combined with the fact that the culture has slipped through their fingers, just makes for a totally depressing atmosphere for me. The ceremonies were that you and I went to, the midwinter ceremony, that should have had 100, 200 people in the longhouse. There were probably, what, 12 of us, 15? And even when they do go there, the longhouse, such as the strawberry ceremony, which is coming up this month, the people will dress up in their native attire, which is beautiful, but they put it in a suitcase right after the ceremony, right after the dancing is over. They run back over to the ladies' room and the men's room, change their clothes and put on their other clothes. This isn't the way it used to be. They're put-on Indians. They're dress-up Indians. I find that really sad. So many of them have lost the language, and even though they're trying to teach it again, they teach how to say white things in Indian, not the traditional concepts with the language.
There was a incident that you had as far as your degree went. Language.
Right. The university catalog here states that a person whose native tongue is other than English may take proficiency tests in both languages to waive the foreign language requirement. My native language is an Iroquoian dialect. My second language is English. For years, they said, well, we just can't accept that because you can't write your language. It's not a written language, which, of course, is racist, blatantly racist, to say if your language is legitimate, then it's going to be just like ours. After convincing them that the Iroquois languages were legitimate, that, in fact, they are some of the few real American languages, Native American languages, but they are sophisticated and beautiful and intricate and very, very legitimate. They approved my taking a course up on the reservation last summer from the State University of New York in linguistics on how to teach the Iroquois languages. They said this would do in lieu of taking foreign languages down here, which I totally accepted, moved up there, paid for everything, was to graduated in August, was to begin my master's scholarship, my master's study here. 3 days or 5 days before that, I received a letter saying that my degree had been revoked because they realized that that course I took up in New York taught me how to teach the Seneca language, and just because I can teach it doesn't mean I can speak it. They still need proof. So anytime I want to fly down a person with a PhD in the Seneca language to chit-chat in front of them, I could do so. Of course, that in itself is a catch-22. Nowhere in this world is there such a thing as a PhD in the Seneca language. At this time, I have no degree, but I have no need for one either.
You have anything that you would like to?
Yeah, I think so far, not just because of the questions, which of course bring up Native problems, so far I've sounded probably very cynical and very bitter. Could be because you've dragged me up here on a Saturday morning, or it could be that I'm a very cynical and bitter person. But I think I laugh more than most people, I think I love living more than most people I know, and I'm happier than most people I know, and I wouldn't want to be anybody but me. And I get a lot of joy out of living, and I don't want to come across like, wow, life's a drag and white guys made it that way for me, because that's not the way it is. The most important thing I can get across to any of my students is that those of them who go on ego trips because they're Indian or go on guilt trips because they're not, we can't take credit or blame for who our grandfathers and grandmothers were. But we've got to start taking responsibility for who we are and what we do with who we are. And that's what I'm all about.
I should bring one more incident. And I just...
So I can sound more bitter and cynical and negate everything I just said.
They're moving you from this room into one without a window or somewhere else so they can have a window.
I know. We've been here so many years. I had over 150 posters and objects on the walls. File cabinets, you can see, it's going to take me some time to move from here a couple yards across the hall. The issue is primarily one over the window. Student Life, which is a bureaucratic body of the university, wants the office with the window. And that's all there is to it. They supersede any protests that we might have over it. I've gone through the legal appeal process over and over, and at least we've come out ahead. They were going to make us pay $150 to have our phone number changed. Instead, they are going to pay it. They were going to make me get out of here in one day, which is virtually impossible. It was yesterday. I tried. Couldn't do it. So they've given us an extension. So they are giving us some leeway that they haven't extended to any other organization that's been asked to move at any time. They're not going to reprint our stationery or anything like that, though. But after all, we're Indians. We're used to getting moved around.
Just for the record, it's been a pleasure to know you.
Oh, it was mutual. You're a hunk.
I've met a lot of people through you.
That's right. And I survived one tedious weekend in Youngstown because of you during the international festival where you assisted our table and our booth. I'd probably still be there laying under the table.
I don't think I'll forget that.
Oh, I don't think I will either. I don't think I'll forget any of the encounters we've had. Most of them you've made pleasurable out of circumstances that could have been otherwise.
We bickered back and forth on the Youngstown
thing. Yeah, well, I don't know. As soon as you get over your herpes.
I don't think that's wrong.
Well, maybe not that one, but what about the other ones?
Yeah, I was having a good time up to the rest, so.
That's what they all say, you know. Like, oh, well, you pay for your good times, cutie. Oh, no, we were just teasing you. It's so much fun to tease you, Jay. And you, you know, you've given more to individuals up there than any person I've ever taken up there before. A lot of people go up there with the idea of, you know, let's lay an Indian, or let's get some jewelry, some genuine, authentic, whatever. And they make promises, and they never come back, but you have consistently proven yourself over and over again. And I'm not sure the individuals that you've bestowed your interest and energy on, I don't know if they deserve it, but they certainly should be very grateful that you've pulled through and come through, because you've lived up to everything you said you would ever do up there. And that's a real rare thing.
Nice. I started out to try to compliment you, and you turned out to compliment me.
Well, the biggest compliment is being friends. Yeah, that's it. You don't have to put words to it. Me either. What the heck, you know? We don't need to say anything else. Where's one of my posters? I just had to take them all off the wall or I could read it. it was so profound, too. Where is it? It was a real good one about friendship, but we don't need a poster either.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.